everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Is My Son. I'm your host, Kathy Fisher, and with me today I have, yet again, guest number one for this show. He is a security boy, and he just came back from the security show, where they found out about all the bugs and e-worms and viruses. Yes, it's your pal, Max Eddy. Hi, Max.
Hello, Kathy, and hello to all you young lovers out there.
This got a lot sexier, just like real suddenly.
Thank you. That's what I'm here for.
This is a predominantly like clean show. You know that, right?
I'm going to keep it real clean.
Okay. It's good to hear, I guess.
Isn't it?
Is it? It's starting to sound dirty again.
There's nothing dirty about this, Kathy. Just be cool. And let's talk about your son.
No, let's start with your son.
You want to start with my son?
You propose. The person who proposes goes first.
Okay. I actually,
if you've listened to the show, that's the structure.
I was a little bit unclear on that because when we did this the first time, it was sort of a out of mutual hatred and contempt, and now we're here again.
What? No, so, the first one is a son that you said that we wanted to do that one, and we didn't have to do that one.
I understand.
Anyways,
so I'm going to cut to it. My son is Wilco's Star Wars, which was released summer last year. It was released in the middle of the night with no fanfare and no announcement. I only found out about it because I couldn't sleep and I was looking at Wilco's Instagram feed, and I was nude in my,
which is what you do for 5 hours a day.
Yep. I love Wilco a lot, as Kathy can tell you. I've had dreams about them. So I jumped up out of my chair and ran over to my computer, and I downloaded it because it was made available for free in a low-res, low-quality file, but, you know, good enough to listen to. And I downloaded it, and my first thought while listening to – well, my first thought was, this can't be real. It's called Star Wars. Are they trying to, like, bait Disney to sue them? And it has this weird cat on the cover. And I listened to it and was like, this is really good, but these all sound like demos. I wonder when the real album is going to come out. and then I went to bed. And I woke up the next morning and everyone's like, no, this is the real thing. Like, this is it. So I listened to it again. And it clicked with me pretty quickly. I do love Wilco, but what I find remarkable about this album is since 2007's Sky Blue Sky, I feel like Wilco has been much more broader in their sound. I know that their writing has been more collaborative, and some people pin a sea change to that. But I don't like to read into it too much. But Sky Blue Sky, Wilco, the album, The Whole Love, they're pretty strong albums. I actually like The Whole Love quite a bit, but they feel much more like compilations than whole albums. And I think what stands out to me about Star Wars is that it is really tight. It sounds very cohesive. It sounds like the most cohesive thing they've put out in years. That goes a long way for me. If I was to pick like the son of sons, like the Wilco album that is nearest and dearest to my heart, it would probably be A Ghost Is Born. But I know you have already heard that. Mm-hmm. And A Ghost Is Born was another album that I listened to and actually loathed at first. I listened to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot when I was 16, and I didn't like that very much either. And A Ghost Is Born, I should back up. I got really into Yankee Hotel Foxtrot for years. I was like moody teen going around listening to Jeff Tweedy talking about how he's an American aquarium drinker. And then A Ghost Is Born came out, and I got super pumped for it. And I bought it, I think the week it came out. So like late June 2004. I have this up in front of me. I don't actually have these dates memorized.
Sure you don't. Well, you have your diary up.
Yeah, exactly. my diary is actually pretty useless to find information because it just says Jeff Tweedy and there's a bunch of hearts around it. And then it says Mr. Max Eddy, Jeff Tweedy.
Mr. Max Tweedy.
No, Mr. Max Eddy, Jeff Tweedy. I will take his whole name.
Okay. Your last name will be Jeff Tweedy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But when A Ghost Is Born came out, it's a pretty dramatic departure from Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And it was like, I thought it was terrible. I was like angry and felt betrayed, and it took me probably another year to warm up to that one. And Wilco for a while had this reputation of like every album that they put out was like dramatically different than the one that preceded it. But I think from Sky Blue Sky to Whole Love, it's been an evolution, but a very like much quieter, much more song by song kind of evolution. And to me, Star Wars is the most exciting, most vital album they've put out in a long time.
So you use the word dramatic to describe the differences between Wilco albums. And I, on the other hand, having listened to at least, you know, Ghost Is Born, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, several of their earlier ones, and this one, Star Wars, I don't see very much difference between any of them.
Well, you wouldn't.
I have an unrefined Wilco palette.
I think if you listen to like the AM, the first album AM in 95, and followed by Being There in Summer Teeth, like that is also that's an evolution of their sound. But I think each of those sounds pretty dramatically different. Where AM is very kind of loose and punky 90s alt country, like very, very much in the vein of what was, I hesitate to say popular, but what was alt country at the time. And then Being There in Summer Teeth, like getting progressively more depressed, with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and A Ghost Is Born being like outliers on a scatterplot drawing of all their albums. I feel like those two are so, so different. I understand like why Yankee Hotel Foxtrot had so much appeal at the time. Like it's a really, really good album, and it's so different that it could appeal to people who'd never listened to it before. I don't know if Star Wars has that same kind of appeal. I was talking to my brother, who is much more musically inclined than I am. He's getting a degree in bass right now. Not from Bootsy Collins Funk U, but from an actual university.
Like a real school.
Like a real big boy school. Not one that's online and run or branded by Bootsy Collins.
Not one of those new YouTube schools.
Yeah, exactly. YouTube U, a degree granting institution. But he was pointing out to me that Star Wars has like influences of math rock, which is something I'd never heard of. And
Can you explain what math rock is?
So the first track on Star Wars, it's called EKG, and it's an instrumental number. Uh-huh. And it is, from what I understand, it is pretty math rocky. The point of math rock is it's fast and it has complicated rhythms and abrupt tempo and time changes. And it kind of gets to a punk aesthetic by being really difficult to play. So while punk music was extremely simplistic and loud, math rock is kind of the opposite. It's very complex and loud, but because it's so complex, it sounds looser and rougher than.
So it's calculated chaos rather than messy chaos.
I think it's more like it's so difficult that that it makes you sound bad playing it because it's just so difficult to play. That's kind of how I've been had it explained to me. It's like if you took the virtuosity of like neo metal, new metal or whatever the fuck it's called, and then just kept yelling at the guys, "Now faster, 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 damn it!" and you'd probably end up somewhere around math rock.
I guess maybe, I don't know. I'm not attuned to what is difficult or not difficult guitar playing.
Again, this is kind of over my head.
Yeah, but I don't know. It didn't strike me. It struck me as more of an experimental noise rock track rather than a, like, this is a technically difficult track.
I think that they're rooted in the same traditions. Nels Klein, the guy that has taken over for lead guitar since, I think when they were touring A Ghost Is Born, because A Ghost Is Born is all, it's just Jeff Tweedy and two other guys. Like the band had been greatly reduced by that point. And Nels Klein is a virtuoso guitar player, but he's also does like a lot of art rock, experimental art rock, but also noise and punk influenced noise. So he's been bringing that sort of like wild aesthetic there for a while. I keep saying aesthetic. It's because I sent you that picture of a vaporwave sweatshirt earlier today.
Yeah, my aesthetic.
I was looking for new aesthetic rugs. I couldn't find any.
You found vaporwave sweatshirts.
If anyone's out there and is like, I'm looking for a new way to make money from Max Eddy, I will pay $200 to $400 to get a vaporwave rug.
Like just with some 3D dolphins on it. CGI dolphins.
Yeah, maybe like the Windows.
Just like the Windows 95 logo.
Yeah, yeah. Less dolphins, more Windows 95 logo. I like that one that just says the word aesthetic and there's an AK-47 on a pyramid. I think that's pretty cool. I think that Star Wars is really tightly composed. I think EKG sets the tone and everything is kind of moving around that. With the exception of The Joke Explained, which feels to me like a track left over from maybe like Wilco the album. It's like it's almost like a sung like a parody of a Bob Dylan song, and like I don't know. I find it kind of tedious, but But everything else on this, I'm actually super down with.
So you mentioned earlier that you've had dreams about Jeff Tweedy, and I have been thinking about this, you know, in light of this week's Sun that you gave me, and also we recently got a email missive from the current staffers of the Gargoyle, basically asking for
the Gargoyle, the fraternal organization to which we both belong.
Yes, the magazine that we both worked for in college, and which is basically the context in which we met. And I was realizing, you know, thinking back, I've got my big file. I've got a filing cabinet of Max Eddy in my brain. And I think one of the first items that was filed in that was Max Eddy semi-erotic Jeff Tweedy dream.
It wasn't that erotic.
Well, it was romantic.
Which one are you talking about? The one where I'm...
The one where he took you to live on an island.
Oh, okay. So, no, you're remembering this a little bit differently. In the dream, sure. I'm rowing a boat over placid blue waters. And in front of me is almost like a child's drawing of like a beautiful green island. It's like a sort of perfect semicircle with a single palm tree coming out of the water. And I rowed towards it, and who should I find on this island but all of Wilco? And I'm trying to play it cool, like, oh, Wilco, this is so exciting that you're on this island. Hi, Jeff Tweedy. And they're just sort of, like, tolerating me. They're sort of like, oh, hey, I guess you're here too, huh? I was like, yeah, isn't this exciting? And they're like, I don't know. And then I feel really guilty, like I'm inconveniencing them.
So there's a lot of other subtle issues going on there, but I think the core part is that you really wish you could go to the Wilco Island and live there with them.
Well,
you expect they probably won't accept you.
Yeah,
but
when I saw Wilco in 2006 at Lollapalooza, and Jeff Tweedy shouted to the crowd, "We're starting a cult," I have never been more excited. But it's funny because they now run a convention. Like a Wilco convention called the Solid Sound Tour, and they hold it usually, I think it's like a modern art museum in Massachusetts, and people can camp out there, they can stay in hotels nearby, and there's like outdoor art and lots of concerts, and I think like three or four just Wilco concerts, but then they get other people. They had like Yola Tango one year and Sonic Youth another year, sort of in the dad noise rock category in which I find myself frequently. So they have this event, and it's, you know, it's not cheap to go to. I want to say it's like $250 for tickets, but I've never gone. I kind of reached like peak Wilco fanboy, and then there's nowhere to go but down from there. So while Wilco is still probably like the favorite band of mine that I discovered on my own, not like something I inherited as like a family heirloom of media, but it's something that is very much mine. Wilco is still, you know, at the top.
Wilco lives in your heart.
Yeah.
And your heart will go on.
My heart will go on. But I'm curious to know what you thought of this album, because you said you hadn't heard this one, but you've heard some of their earlier work, and it sounds like you kind of missed out on their middle period, like Sky Blue Sky, Wilco the album, and The Whole Love.
Yeah, I think A Ghost Is Born is probably the latest album that I own and listened to.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fine. I've always sort of felt at best, like, I think I enjoy Wilco. Like, if I'm driving the car and a Wilco song comes on the radio, like, I'm not going to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never been something that clicks with me in a strong emotional way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I think Jeff Tweedy, I will acknowledge, is probably, you know, one of the greatest rock and roll songwriters of recent decades.
Which is weird to think about, that like, someone I, not know personally, but, like, an act that I feel invested in has reached that point. It's very odd to me.
Well, I mean, they're established. Wouldn't you have been around for 25 years or whatever?
Probably longer than that. But
however long they've been around.
I guess growing up in the shadow of like the of the classic rock and the Beatles and the early rock and roll, and seeing those as like the pillars of popular music that have already gone before. It's weird to me to like be to have a contemporary act that I actually like be so renowned.
Really? I mean, there has to be someone in every generation who's the best.
I know that. I mean, like, rationally, I know that. And also, like I really like the White Stripes and Jack White. And then the White Stripes are, you know, are probably going to be held up as, like, the ideal imagining of the garage rock late 90s sound. But it still, seems weird to me.
Jack White is a good rock and roll star, but I don't think he's that great of a songwriter.
He's definitely
Which I think
not.
Is a distinction to make.
I also think that I don't know if you felt this way. Well, I should let you go on because I feel like I cut you off.
Yeah, I have not actually started saying my opinion yet, really.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
So I think it was good. I mean, there are plenty of songs that I like on there. I would say, like, Random Name Generator is good.
Really strong track, yeah.
What are some of the other ones I liked? I mean, they're all solid, but just it's not something that clicks with me. And mm-hmm. I think there's been a few Wilco songs that I really do like and have listened to multiple times, but I think this to me is sort of just, to me, seems like standard Wilco, and maybe that's because I missed that middle chunk of albums.
That's interesting. Okay.
So to me, it's very similar to the earlier work. Here's another thing I think about when I was listening to it recently, and I think putting it up against, say, last week's Son of Mine, Lord Huron, is that I don't care for Jeff Tweedy's voice that much, or I don't find it to be... He just doesn't have, it's not that great of an instrument,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it does not sing super melodically, and his range is not very wide.
Yeah.
So I guess I think you've said this about me before, but I tend to lean towards music that has stronger vocals in it.
Yeah, I actually struggle to describe what I think of when I think of Kathy music, but I can definitely, like, every time I hear something that you really like, I'm like, yep. Yeah, this is right in there, but
can't describe it, but I know when I see it.
Yeah, I'm like the Supreme Court in pornography.
Oh, I also, here's the other observation about Jeff Tweedy is that if the concept of ruefulness could have a voice, that's what Jeff Tweedy sounds like.
Ruefulness?
Yeah, ruefulness.
What is ruefulness? Is that like R-O-F-L?
No, R-U-E-F-U-L.
Oh, ruefulness. Oh.
Ruefulness.
I was like, you know, rolling on the floor laughing, popular.
No, not ruffleness. That's ruffles. Totally different.
Yeah, I don't think Jeff Tweedy ruffles. In fact, he wrote a...
I was saying a real word and you were saying a fake word.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just a random name generator.
I suppose.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that you should say that this sounds like their earlier work, and I wonder if maybe that's why I like it so much, that I do hold those particular albums in such high regard that this sounds so much like those, maybe that's why I'm connecting so much with it. I'd like to think that that isn't the case, and that there's just a particular difference to this album that connects with me, but I think
you probably have a better ear for the subtle differences between different Wilco periods than I do. So I mean, I would trust your expertise. I don't think that I'm necessarily the authority on this. My other opinion is that I do enjoy the name Star Wars and the album art.
Yeah, they're great.
I think are fantastic, and I do like the fact that it came to you as if in a dream that you possibly willed it into existence, because you texted me like when it came out. And you're like, oh my god, Wilco just released a new album.
I have no memory of this.
You definitely did. You might have just texted all of your friends. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I just shouted like, Siri, text everyone. There's a new Wilco album out. Texting 98 people.
All your friends. Every single contact you have in your phone.
It's just you, Chris, and Zach, and, you know, maybe like five or six other people, like 98 times. It's just, that's just it. I love the album art as well. There's a release of this. I don't know. I think it might be the one I have, because they released it for free and you could download it, which I did do. But then I also bought it on vinyl because why the fuck not? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the one that I have, but it has a holographic cover so that when you move the cover, the cat appears to wink at you.
That's pretty cool.
And when you open it up, the inner sleeve to the album is one of those deep dream neural network interpretations of the cat. It's really upsetting.
Does it warrant that fanciness level? I guess I don't get the amazingness. I don't feel the wonder. I want to feel the childlike wonder, Max.
You mean the album or the album art?
Everything about the whole album. The album as a piece of art.
So I think maybe what strikes me about it is that this album feels very, very raw and very unafraid and unselfconscious. It has a really provocative name, a very silly name, one that I'm sure that they were tossing around as a joke, but they're like, no, let's just fucking do it. Star Wars. Like, why not? And yeah, and I like that the band is in a position where they can release a song, not just a song, but the entire album for free. I won't retread like the whole the Wilco mythos, but the band does have a really long history of making their albums available. They're one of the first to do that, to make them available for streaming or even for download for free. I think maybe that's what strikes me about this is that it does feel very while the other Wilco albums of late have felt very, very carefully produced and manufactured, and not in a bad way. Like there's definitely some highlights in there, but they feel very, like very precious objects. And this feels like much, much rougher, much looser, and a little bit more lively.
I have one last comment.
Well, I was going to say, I think it elicits childlike wonder from me, but I'm perfectly willing to admit that is just from my own experience with Wilco, the concept.
You just love concepts.
I do.
One other question.
Mm.
Are guitars still cool?
Boy, that's a really tricky question. I don't know. I can say from experience, because for a while I would see Wilco every single year. I no longer do this for money reasons, but Wilco has some cool guitars. Now, I don't know if guitars as a concept, wink, are cool with the kids anymore, since they're all vaping and listening to EDM and Vaporwave. I do think that Wilco is definitely of an older generation. They're obviously older men. I would think Jeff Tweedy's probably like in his mid-50s by this point, if not a little older. And I think they're still very much rooted in that classic rock mentality. Big guitars, big guitar sounds, but they have always had a little bit more of an experimental edge to them, and I think maybe that's why they have been more successful, or continue to be more successful.
Because my thing is, I'm worried that I don't find guitars cool anymore.
I think that's a good thing.
So I can't enjoy rock.
I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing.
It could be, but I feel like I've written off an entire genre, or it's just a genre that doesn't have the effect on me that it has on other people. This is another just a reaction, because I've been continuing to think about Guided by Voices from last week.
Yeah.
Because I don't get a visceral thrill from like guitar sound anymore.
Well, as a white man, I can tell you that guitars are cool and that white guys think guitars are cool.
Therefore, it's true.
Yeah. And I would actually put Guided by Voices and Wilco into like the same, you know, stuff white people like category.
Specifically stuff white dudes like.
Yeah, very much so. I don't want to make gross generalizations. I've gone to a lot of Wilco shows, and they will occasionally draw a pretty diverse crowd.
I'm definitely not saying that women can't enjoy Wilco, just that there's certain skewing.
Yeah, and I would hesitate to like try to pull that apart, but I do think that Wilco is definitely on the fringes of that more traditional male white post blues rock sound that began with Elvis Presley and lots of white musicians co-opting African American music and then turning it into this. But you know, they have been willing to experiment. I think it's pretty bold that they did a song like EKG, the band that they are, one of the, you know, they don't have to take those kind of risks anymore. And I think it's interesting that they do. And what got me, I guess the thing that still gets me excited about this album is, in addition to just being a great album for me to listen to that I really enjoy, I like that a band that has been around since, I want, like, 1995, I think, and has been famous since, like, 2001, is still putting out, like, really good albums, albums that receive critical and commercial acclaim. And I think that's really great, you know. And again, maybe this is coming of age in the decline of the Rolling Stones and the big acts from the 60s and 70s becoming, like, self-parodies to the point where, like, all they do is play their old songs because no one gives a shit about their new albums. I think it's really great that Wilco is still interesting enough to put something like this out.
Okay. I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
I think. Let's move on to your son, your beautiful boy.
Well, we have to rate, Max.
Oh.
We must rate.
Oh boy. So
I must rate your son.
Okay, rate.
Otherwise,
rate
how will son. We know how good? You don't have to rate your own.
Mm, no, rate my
you gotta
son.
Listen to the previous episodes.
But can I? I have. I was on. I was on one.
Okay, I know.
Can I recommend the scale on which it be rated?
This is unprecedented, Max, so
I don't want to
have to consider it.
Yeah.
But yes, you may.
Okay. How many Lord Hurons is this?
Max, you're putting yourself in a tricky position.
Mm-hmm.
You rating one son relative to another son?
Yeah, in units of your son.
Okay, so we're saying that would 5 out of 5 Lord Hurons equal the concept of Lord Huron as a whole?
I think
or would one Lord Huron mean standard Lord Huron? 5 is 5 times as good as Lord Huron.
I think it would be, so like 0 Lord Hurons would be complete failure, and 5 Lord Hurons would be the perfect conception of Lord Huron, like the, you know, what we see of Lord Huron is just the shadows dancing on the wall, but 5 would be turning around and seeing what's in front of the fire.
So 4 would maybe be normal Lord Huron, or Lord Huron as I understand it?
I think like 3.
Oh, really? Max, you are painting yourself into a tricky spot.
Yeah, because I think 4, at 4 you've like turned your head 90 degrees, you're not at 180 yet, but you can see the fire flickering and the movements of the dancer, of Lord Huron.
Okay, and just this album or Wilco in general?
Let's just do this album.
Sure.
Because if we were going to do Wilco in general, I would have pulled a Popham and said, like, you should listen to this one and A Ghost Is Born.
I've listened to A Ghost Is Born before, though.
But you should listen to it. I would have asked you to listen to it
again.
You
should listen to it every day.
I mean, I did for a while.
I think I can only give it 2 Lord Hurons.
Okay.
From that scale, because you're setting a very ambitious
mm-hmm.
rating, so mm-hmm. that I'm sorry.
No, I think, I mean, honestly, I think Lord Huron is great, and I know how in what high regard you hold them, so to me, that's a compliment.
Okay.
Before we go on, and you can cut this out, but I've actually wanted to talk to you about Lord Huron for a while because I'm fascinated by them. I think about them and Blanche a lot.
Uh-huh.
You've heard Blanche, right?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like, yeah, yeah. Do you like them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like them, Lord Huron and Blanche is like, if you sat down and you're like, we're going to make a movie, and we're going to make a movie about like spooky Americana bullshit, but we need music for it, so just like make up music for that, make up like a non-existent, like what would you hear on the radio in this movie?
Uh-huh.
Not even like real music, like this is like, I guess I may not be using this word right, but it feels a little bit like this is like pastiche so close to art, like it feels like it's so good, and it like it has such a strong, I feel like a strong concept behind it,
mm-hmm.
like a drive, an intention, a particular,
and a unity behind it.
Yeah, like Blanche is not going to put more albums out, but Lord Huron is like scratching that like spooky alt country thing for me. The kind of thing that like I'm amazed it exists outside of like a soundtrack.
Yeah, well, I think that I mean maybe it's just me. But I think that there's an interest in that, because I feel like there's a certain branch of popular music has shifted into the sort of like the concept or the meaning behind songs is meaningless. So we're not even going to bother to do anything interesting with, you know, lyrically
mm-hmm.
or conceptually. And then they're sort of on the opposite end where it's like, yeah, I mean, it's not like this is like a real story. So it's not like we're going to have, you know, deep, authentic emotion or anything in it, but it's, we're going to do some sort of basically a fictional narrative in the music. And I find it really interesting. I mean, I am a person who likes, you know, storylines.
Yeah.
Things to have storylines and concepts.
And that album in particular,
Strange Trails.
Strange Trails is, I think that one is so much fun for minds like yours and mine, that like to try to puzzle things together and figure things out. And the fact that there isn't like a real answer to the question that it poses, a real narrative there. It's like building blocks. I'm constantly rearranging them in my mind and finding like, oh, maybe this is what this means. But
we should write fan fiction for it.
I've actually thought about it like 100%.
Strange Trails fanfic. I would co-write Strange Trails fanfic with you.
But even beyond Strange Trails, was it Lonesome Moon?
Lonesome Dreams.
Lonesome Dreams. Yeah, Lonesome Dreams. Just like the sound of Lord Huron sounds so much like it's like genre fiction music.
Well, have you seen the music videos they did for, especially for Lonesome Dreams? Because they did, it was basically 70s genre movies.
Oh, no, I saw one of the ones that they did for Strange Trails. It was really long and I kind of didn't like it, but...
No, the Fool for Love one isn't good, but the Lonesome Dream ones are really good. There's one that's like a Western chase scene and there's one like a mystical, like... semi-fantasy adventure thing. They're very weird and very cool. You should definitely check those out.
I guess what I'm wondering is, like, is this the same kind of art that is like, is it still like miraculous art? This feels very constructed to me. I feel like they have a theme and they have this American Life. Every week we pick a theme and several stories about that theme. But I feel like their sound and their lyrics and a lot of their like general aesthetic is built around like a particular concept. Maybe like a little bit. That's a little bit like the White Stripes and a little bit like, I don't know, Gorillaz. I would actually kind of put them similar to that. Hmm. Does it still feel authentic? Because it still feels authentic to me, even though I understand it to be kind of pastiche, constructed.
There are plenty of things that are fictional narratives that still feel authentic. I don't think, I think that we create this sort of false expectation for music a lot of times that it has to be drawing on your personal experience. And I think that's bullshit. I mean, all other art is heavily based on, you know, fantasy and on, you know, imagination. Mm-hmm. But we, for some reason, decide that music has to be like your artist's pain much more than, you know, if I'm writing fiction or making a TV show or something like that. And I'm perfectly fine with having a fictional narrative because it still, to me, at least Lord Huron still elicits emotion and it gets me, you know, intellectually and emotionally excited.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's, you know, fun and interesting.
That was a good conversation.
Welcome back to This Is My Son. I am still here with Max Eddie, and in this segment, we will discuss my son. So I think the reason why I went in this direction with my son is not necessarily because of a thematic connection with Wilco, but is more so that I know that Wilco lives in a place deep inside the heart of Max Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to find something that lived equally deep in my heart. So I went a long ways back, and I went very deep.
I believe your exact words were, I'm going to have to dig something out of my id.
Yeah, that was what I said. And it's what I did. So the song that I picked was the original cast recording of The Phantom of the Opera, the musical.
Yep.
And this son for me came into existence or reached its stature sometime. I've been trying to figure this out over the past week, but it was sometime in the early to mid 90s.
Mm-hmm.
When earlier in the 90s, my parents went on like a, you know, parents alone weekend to Toronto. And while they were there, they saw the Toronto company performing Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. And then they brought back with them this soundtrack. And after that, basically, it became a critical part of my day-to-day life, listening to it. And eventually, the next time they went to Canada, they took my sister and I, and we saw it. And I think subsequently, I've probably seen it two-ish more times.
Wow.
I think both in Detroit. And, you know, I've also been read the original book. I read what I would consider to be the authentic canon, which is, of course, Susan Kay's Phantom, which is a published piece of fan fiction that's excellent, which I wanted you to have to read, but I know it would have been a little bit of an imposition to do both that.
I mean, you already imposed on me quite a bit.
Listen, it's a son to son exchange. It was one album to one album.
It is.
That is not an imposition. It's an equal trade.
I will say that I feel that you did find something that like matched an integral part of your life as Wilco is to mine. I had the experience that I sometimes have of when someone shares something with you that's like a really important thing to them, that listening to it feels like wrong. Like intrusive.
It's too intimate.
Yeah, kind of. Like I remember I have a very distinct feeling in college where a friend of mine gave me like a mix CD of her favorite band, and it was like, I feel like I'm watching them dancing in their underwear. Like this feels wrong.
Well, you know, you could say that, but also the Phantom of the Opera, and I read this in the wiki, I was not actually aware of it, is the most profitable piece of entertainment ever created.
Wow.
So a lot of people have seen it, so it's not quite that intimate. But it definitely was a very formative part of my life and my tastes in a lot of things, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I've been thinking about sort of the themes and storyline, trying to explain it maybe. Because I think at the most superficial level, in terms of story, it's like it's a Beauty and the Beast style story. Of, you know, a hideous man who falls in love with a beautiful woman and is redeemed via that love. But then thinking about it more, I think it's fundamentally kind of different because in the standard Beauty and the Beast situation, the Beast becomes beastly because he was an asshole.
Right.
Like, he was cursed to be ugly. Whereas in the Phantom of the Opera, it's purely like fate, you know, birth, disfigurement type of thing. And even though in the story, you know, he's a genius in pretty much every sense, the way the world treats him and potentially some personal flaws make him essentially a psychopath murderer.
Yeah.
So that's a component, but I think it's an interesting inversion too of a common Western societal narrative of, I mean, typically in Western society, what a man looks like is not that important.
Hmm.
Like most of the canon, it's primarily about like what a guy's, you know, skills are, what he's capable of, what his brain is. And the more superficial element are usually more feminine driven things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is kind of an inversion of that.
To an intellectual beast, I mm-hmm. think. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, it's definitely got a lot of, potential psychological areas to plumb going on and why I like it and why it's probably so popular. But I know that you mentioned before this that you had not read the synopsis and you wanted to be able to summarize it based on purely having listened to the album. So I'm sort of curious to hear that.
Yeah, I want to see if I can find like a track listing. That would actually be enormously helpful to remind me of what
I think was. The Wikipedia page does have a track listing.
It does not. While I look for a track listing, I'm curious if you've heard the sequel.
Yes, it's so bad.
I will do my interpretation of The Phantom of the Opera in a moment, but I have had the sequel described as that the Phantom escapes Paris and goes to Coney Island.
Yes, that's what happens. It's awful.
And he's still with Christine, I guess.
No, he's not. I mean, Raoul's with Christine.
Oh, it's some other woman?
Raoul turns out to be like a degenerate drinker. So Meg, they come to America too, and I think like the Phantom is like running like a funhouse
yeah.
type thing at Coney Island, and like Meg is in love with him, and it's like, what?
And there's like a kid.
Christine, yeah, they have like a child that is implied as the Phantom's child. I mean, there's like no fucking reason why it exists. It's the stupidest thing, and it's not even, the music isn't even good.
I think
it's purely just Andrew Lloyd Webber cashing in.
I've heard that it's Andrew Lloyd Webber fan fiction, that it's like beautifully, it sounds beautiful, but that it's just complete garbage.
It doesn't even sound, the music isn't even good though.
I mean,
it's not.
You know, we should have gone to see Phantom, the Las Vegas Spectacular.
Oh no. Here's the thing too. Yeah, so many versions of this story have been made, and so many of them are really shitty. So.
Oh man, the copyright was recently released. And in 2012, the first school in the UK performed the show. High school production of The Phantom of the Opera.
There's a lot of very complex set pieces in this musical that would be interesting to see done in a high school production.
All right, so here I go. I'm gonna do my best. So the story begins on eBay, where some motherfucker buys some junk, and it gets him thinking about big organs and crap. And then we cut to a racist Italian stereotype, and she's singing poorly, but then there's another woman who sings better, and then there's a song that doesn't make any sense to me. And then we find out that she's actually been Stockholmed and or brainwashed by this nerd that lives in the wall. and then there's some really dramatic songs that sound like they were produced by Phil Collins. And then we get to the music of the night. And then all of this, I assume, is happening inside of her bathroom. And then there's apparently a song called Magical Lasso. And fuck, I don't remember what the hell happened there. Oh, boy. So then we get back to the racist Italian caricatures. And that nerd is leaving some really mean messages on their forum posting, talking about how he doesn't like the show. And he's got some demands about how that's going to be done, and they're like, "Nah, man, we don't negotiate with terrorists." And he's like, "Okay, I'm going to mess up your lighting." And everyone's like, "No, okay." Act two. 6 months later, they fix their lamp, and there's a song about going to Eyes Wide Shut, and then everyone's having a great time. But oh shit, the nerd's there. And the nerd's like, "Look, I wrote some fan fiction. You have to do it." And then the rest of these songs actually make no sense to me at all. they cease to advance the plot after that, except that the nerd is like really needy and is really kind of a control freak. And then it turns out Raoul's a bad guy, maybe. And then it just sort of ends.
I think you may have missed a couple things. listen, in general, you've got sort of a sketch of it down. I think you might be missing a couple key plot points, though.
That's fair. I think this is interesting, though, that I have yet to see. I actually watched. I went to a little bit of opera in the last couple of weeks, which is really nice, and I should do that more often. But I was thinking that I've never seen an opera that I've liked past the first act. And
really?
Because the first act is what's there to hook you. All the really, really dramatic stuff, all the really cool stuff is in the very beginning. All of the plot happens in the beginning. Because the thing about opera, and maybe like listening to this, I got the same impression that like the middle of it isn't really a resolution. Like there's no building. And then it just sort of, and then they finally resolve it at the end. Also with opera, once you're into like the second and third acts, they start doing like the ballets and just less interesting stuff. Like it just becomes virtuosity at that point, kind of like just like showing off. It doesn't really strike me. Like Turandot, the first act of Turandot is fucking incredible. And the rest of it's just sort of to me.
I would say what it is that they tend to put comedy in the first act more. There's more of like wacky characters, and then the tragedy usually happens at the end. And granted, my view of opera is mostly inflected by the fact that I took an entire class in college about tubercular heroines dying in opera, which is a lot of Italian opera.
Jesus, that's amazing. How much time did you spend on La Boheme? Just like all of it? Or
no, I mean, not as much as like La Traviata and so a few other ones. But yeah, I mean, that was a chunk of it, obviously. There was a lot more of those than you'd imagine.
So I have some questions about the Phantom of the Opera.
Sure.
I had trouble telling if the work wanted us to feel bad for the Phantom, because I didn't read the synopsis. I had a really hard time sympathizing with him.
You are supposed to feel sad for him.
Okay.
And I will say this is the thing, it benefits from actually seeing the musical, because there's, an element of visual acting in a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And like several of the, or at least the key love song between Christine and Raoul, who are, you didn't mention Raoul really till the end of your faux synopsis. is like watched by the Phantom.
Mm.
Like he is basically subjected to like falling in love and then getting totally like shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, in a cynical worldview, a cynical modern worldview might be like, oh yeah, he's just a suffering dude, and it's but he's actually just a dick, and he believes that he's entitled to love even though he's not. But I think that's a simplistic way to view it. I think it is a pretty pathos-filled gothic romance,
yeah,
as far as they go.
Gothic is definitely the how I would describe this.
That's the time period it came out of. It was like around the turn of the 20th century that the book was written.
Which I like, actually. All the bits where they're like singing about being in dark, dingy labyrinths, wearing masks and being Byronic in the basement is that's pretty cool to me.
They got an underground lake. There's like candles coming up out of the floor. Like I can just vouch for it. It's
that's
cool.
Fucking great.
There's a lot of the 80s and musical camp coming through. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So that hasn't aged well. And it definitely like, I don't like musicals in general. And Andrew Lloyd Webber as like a renowned master of musicals as a form. The music of musicals like tends to not really do a lot with me. But this one, like as much as I'm loath to admit it, I have had tons of these songs stuck in my head. I listened to this 3 times. I really want... I didn't just do this once, Kathy. I was serious about this.
I listened to the Wilco songs, or Wilco album several times.
Yeah, I wanted to do just the Phantom of the Opera, but actually I couldn't because I had to work. And I can't listen to things with English while I work. It screws up my writing. But I've listened to this several times. And there's a lot of earworms on this album. And there's also like an interesting kind of a musical obsession with dichotomy that I think is happening here. Like, the stuff with the Phantom and the most dramatic pieces have like 80s drum machines and electric guitars and like
synth heavy.
Yeah. Like modern, or contemporary production value on it. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting like sonic marker for the Phantom, like more so than he's got a theme, very Wagnerian. There's a lot of like leitmotifs that are visited throughout this work. Mm-hmm. But in addition to a theme, like he has a particular sound.
It's like sort of rock. It's vaguely rock and roll plus organ, rock organ.
It's like goth rock kind of. Yeah. And it's got like, it's more, I really wish this one times. I really wish I had like the musical background, but it's like, it's more minor and diminished than the other stuff. So even when
the other stuff is also very heavily, it's like pastiche of opera in a lot of parts.
I was going to say that, and I think that's interesting because at least part of the narrative, as I understand it, is that the Phantom is like this musical genius, and there's a bit in I think it's track 3 on disc 2, Notes/Twisted Every Way. Mm-hmm. Where some of the actors are trying to work through his script. And the line is nobody tangles, everyone who tangles with Don Juan or something like
those
that.
Those who tangle with Don Juan.
Yeah.
And, I know every lyric in this album, sorry.
Okay. So, and again, I could be way off about this, but it's, to me, it sounded like the actor would sing it in what is a, like, an over-exaggerated version of what Italian opera sounds like. Mm-hmm. And then the director would be like, no, no, no. It, and not the Phantom, the director would go, no, 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 it sounds like this. And they would play it out. And it sounds much more modern, much more like what the Phantom is sounds like his yeah. music, the way he's represented. So there's like a musical dichotomy there. And then there's like the dichotomy of like love and death and madness and genius, I think is definitely coming through this. I feel like there's a lot of the tension comes from that. And I don't know how like mirrored the Phantom is in Raoul. And how other characters might be represented with other characters. But I think that there's like a core tension that's explored really nicely through those kind of dualities. So like if I was to say this is bad music, like that would just be wrong. Like this is masterfully made, wonderfully written. The song, the Masquerade song, like seriously, I hate it because it's just like, this is just some syncopated bullshit. Like this is calculated to get stuck in my head.
And just goes da 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 da.
Yeah, and it does every fucking time. And how they come back to that at the end, I'm like, oh, you son of a bitch. And as much as I wish that I didn't find like the Phantom of the Opera song like thrilling and catchy, but it absolutely is. I was a little bit disappointed though because the overture starts with this incredible organ sound, and then they just kind of don't come back to that like as big and as powerful. It's like damn. And I like how the guy the Phantom sings. He sounds like such a weirdo. Like it's such a weird voice.
And yeah, it's not a standard musical voice or yeah, musical actor. So I will go into Michael Crawford because I adore him.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Michael Crawford is that he came from basically he was a British TV comedian before this. And I can't remember exactly how, but, you know, he auditioned or something or got discovered as like, hey, by the way, he can sing. Let's get him in this Andrew Lloyd Webber musical as a person who's like his character is supposed to be. Like have a monumentally great voice, but I find it interesting. I think, you know, it's one of the things that's lacked, especially if you ever happen to watch the Joel Schumacher movie,
yeah,
based on this, where Gerard Butler plays the Phantom. He does not have anywhere near the vocal flexibility of Michael Crawford, which is a real bummer. Patrick Wilson plays Raoul though; he's pretty good.
So you were saying that the Phantom is supposed to have all this pathos behind him. And I have to say that from just listening to the lyrics, and this is where I want you to like correct me if I'm wrong or misinterpreting, but the rest of the time you should remain silent. I felt like he is just evil, like not even the murder, but the manipulation and the entitlement and the sense that he is like a Byronic genius and that he molds and manipulates this woman to execute his art, which he believes to be superior to all other art, really did not ring for me. Like the music of this musical is really emotional and it's really attention grabbing in the same way that like opera can be. You really can't ignore like any track on this on these albums, and I totally understand why people love this stuff. Like it is like Gothic Romance is so over the top and so enthralling. It is exactly the kind of shit that just pulls you in, and the music itself is in the same vein of just bombastic and powerful and raw, I guess. Like, but I found that what I understood of the story, if I was to like actually sketch out my understanding of it, was actually pretty contemptible.
I agree. I mean, you can't really defend the Phantom if you're thinking about like what the standards of real world moral standards would be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, put into context, and I think especially there's a couple key things that are not on the soundtrack, but that are in the spoken parts of the musical, including the fact that, like, you know, He, as a child, was basically like cast out from home and became an attraction in a traveling circus, like against his will, basically, was just like captured in a cage. And if you follow the, what I would consider the true canon, basically like went to live, basically built, designed and built much of the opera house and went to live there just because like the world was too mean. Like he couldn't take it anymore. After various travels and being subjected to an awful lot of shit. And then was sort of, I would say, unwillingly drawn out of his shell by falling in love with Christine. Like, I don't think it was like, yeah, I'm going to get me a woman to manipulate and control. It was more like he had totally given up on the world up until then. Other than, you know, extorting opera managers. but you know, it's, he's not necessarily a good person, but he's a sympathetic character because he, you know, it's basically shown to have suffered more than pretty much like everyone. And when he does do bad shit, I mean, some of it is like in a more fun way, like a fun evil person. Like, I would say extorting the managers and like scaring ballerinas is funny.
Yeah.
Murdering people's maybe not so much.
Less so.
but, you know, he only ends up murdering two-ish people in the musical, plus or minus whoever got killed by the chandelier falling. But anyways, it's not, you're not meant to think of it in terms of like what your standard moral frame would be. It's a heightened reality, right? So
right.
I don't judge him by those standards. I judge him by like, you know, dramatic, fictional, gothic romance standards, which are different.
Right. Yeah.
Like you could say, right, in Jane Eyre, Mr. Rochester is a contemptible human being, but you still kind of root for him. You still want him and Jane Eyre to sort of end up together.
I did not for 1 minute want him to end up with Christine.
Oh, no way. Yeah. I mean, like, and he realizes at the end, I don't know if that was clear from the last track either, but
oh,
basically she kisses him. He changes his mind. He's like, yeah, you're right. You should go with Raoul. And then he lets her go. And then he folds into his chair and his cape and then disappears.
He disappears?
Yeah. It's super moving.
Like, is he... So how much supernatural bullshit is happening in this?
That's the only one. He's not, okay, there's not overtly supernatural. He's also shown to be basically a magician ventriloquist.
Yeah.
Throughout. So it's probably assumed that there's some sort of like trap door in his chair or way to get out because there's an angry mob coming to get him, basically.
Right, right.
But so yeah, he lets her go and then he pieces out. And then in the book, he dies of a broken heart. So.
Great. Perfect. Yeah, of all the things that you listed, like scaring ballerinas and even murdering people, what I found to be the most contemptible was like attempting to brainwash Christine. And again, just going from the music, like all the lines about like, oh, my power over you is growing and I'm going to like gaslight you. People won't think I'm real and they're going to think you're crazy. And then she starts to believe that like he has a hold on me even when he's not around, like he's literally inside my head. It was that stuff, like that kind of like abusive boyfriend,
except he's not an abusive boyfriend, he's an abusive like just random sad guy, like because she doesn't establish a mutual relationship. I think it's she has not bought into the relationship. Yeah, so it is a predatory thing. But it's not like a domestic abuse thing. It's just a pure, like, he doesn't understand human relationships real good. So he's going to hypnotize her and bring her down to his house under the opera.
Because I was thinking, like, if this was more like a Faustian kind of thing, and it was, like, actually Satan, like, seducing someone.
Like, you're okay with real Satan. You're just not okay with satanic type people.
What I think the difference is that if this was actual Satan, I don't think we would be asked. If in Faust, you are not asked to sympathize with Satan. You're asked to sympathize with Faust.
But Satan is sympathetic in Faust.
Is he?
Sure.
I guess I should go back and reread that. I don't actually remember Satan like being
Mephisto's
that sympathetic.
A fairly nice guy in Faust. Faust is the jerk. I mean, Faust is the one who like gets Margarita pregnant. And I'll also say, I think it is deliberately meant to be Faustian. I mean, in the original book, instead of the Don Juan triumphant opera, like Faust figures very prominently in it.
Okay.
So there's definitely that. There's a notes of that. There's hints of that in there.
So I guess what I was trying to say was that, like, the kind of seduction of a Faustian arrangement is that the person who is being seduced is
like on board.
Does it of their own free will.
Yeah.
And the difference in this one is that Christine is not. Like, if Satan tempted Faust by just, like, you know, hypnotizing him, that doesn't work. I guess maybe then, like, the real Faustian arrangement of Phantom of the Opera is, like, Satan is off stage and the Phantom has succumbed to that seduction and does bad things because he's given into that. But
I also don't think that the seduction of Christine is, like, a purely one-sided forced thing, because I think when she still believes that he's, like, an angel who's come to teach her, she is conscious of that. Like, she knows it's crazy, but I think she's on board, because, I mean, it's also, you may not have gotten the subtleties of this since you didn't read the synopsis, but she thinks he's basically the spirit of her dead father. So initially, like, when he's teaching her, he's just basically like, I'm a disembodied voice, I'm gonna teach you how to sing real good, and then does it, and then he sort of falls in love with her. He's like, well, but what if I also abducted her to my house?
To my secret underground lake house.
Yeah, so it's not like straight off the bat he's like, yeah, I'm totally gonna use psychological manipulation over you to make you follow my will. It's
but if
more
that
just,
happens, that's cool.
You know? Yeah, you know, if it sometimes things escalate and you end up doing that and you don't even know.
This at the end of the play, he's just like, well, this is crazy. This just all got out of control.
Well, that basically is what happens. He's like, shit, man. You know what? You've got a rich Vicomte who's going to marry you. You just go with him. It's fine. I'll hang out here.
What was I thinking?
Listen, I was wrong. I killed a couple people, but I think I've seen the error of my ways. I'm out.
Yeah, I'm going to go off to Southern Queens.
Could live in this. I'm going to go to the Coney Island. This is the perfect solution.
I'm going to go to Coney Island 100 years from now.
Yeah.
So should I rate it? Should I rate it?
Yeah, go ahead.
What's my unit? You should give me a unit of measurement.
I think you should rate it. How many of the song about Mr. Mephistopheles from Cats it is?
Oh man. Kathy, I would love to do a show with you about Cats, because it's like,
I hate Cats. I think it's an awful
musical. I hate
musical.
It too. It's so bad. Like, I would love to, just because we could just shit on it for so long.
Yeah, it would just be Cats Sucks, the podcast.
Cats Sucks, the musical. I didn't even get into, like, my like hot takes about how I think, you know, theater is dead.
Hey, have you listened to Hamilton?
I haven't. I kind of want to now. But really after good. Listening to Phantom of the Opera, I'm like, oh, maybe I... Actually, listening to Phantom of the Opera, I came home, I was like, I just want to listen to real opera now.
Either way, it's enriching, if you do either way.
Yeah. Before I rate it, I will say, a lot of this does sound like Turandot to me. I think there's a couple of musical themes that are really, really similar in that. And if you like this, you will probably enjoy that. All right. What's my unit again?
The song Mr. Mephistopheles. What is that the full name of the song? Mr. Mephistopheles.
It's the magical Mr. Mephistopheles,
yeah,
I think
that's it. Oh, how many of that out of five?
So is five like the perfect version of magical Mr. Mephistopheles and zero is like nothing like that at all?
Five is like the most transcendent musical theater experience you could have.
Oh, okay. Most transcendent musical theater experience.
Musical theater, not theater and not musical.
And zero is magical Mr. Mephistopheles.
Zero is actually having to sit through all of Cats.
Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. I would give this a 3.5. I did not feel transcended listening to this, but I definitely appreciated it for its value. And I think I liked it. Like it's the kind of like begrudging like really gross candy. Like, oh, I hate that I like this.
It's so sweet, but actually it's really, I can't stop eating it type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel sick afterward, like violently ill.
I feel bad.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll buy you tickets to it and you can see it at some point in New York. Because it's
Cats
still playing.
Cats is coming back to Broadway.
Certainly not Cats. Definitely Phantom of the Opera has been there for like 35 years.
Yeah, Cats was there for, I think, like 25, and then it left for 10 years, and now it's back, motherfucker.
Oh, God. Who wants that?
Apparently a lot of people.
Fuck those people, man.
And this makes me wonder how bad Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark had to be. Like,
you know, probably pretty bad.
Probably pretty bad. Kathy, this was a joy. I thank you for sharing your son with me. I do feel enriched.
Is there anything you'd like to plug today?
Well, not really, actually.
I got nothing going.
I don't. Actually, as you know, our joint project is on indefinite hiatus, and I've really just been enjoying my time. It's been nice. I've been working on myself. I'm doing real good. Actually, if I was going to plug anything, I did just get back from this RSA security conference, and I wrote some stuff about it for PC Mag, and I think this is a really interesting time to live in, security-wise and policy-wise. There's a lot of really, really interesting moments from that 4-day event. So if anyone wants to, like, just Google me and read some of the stuff that I saw, maybe you'll learn something else that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here today.
And then we can follow you on Twitter as both WMEddie?
Yeah, you should probably, I think it's WMaxEddie. Yeah, it's WMaxEddie. Follow me at WMaxEddie because I just got over 1,000 followers and I really want to, like, cement my 1K plus followership.
So you got to get a buffer.
Yeah, I only have like 9 right now. So once they come through and get rid of all the bikini bots, I'm done. I'm going to drop back to like 60.
Okay. And in your normal non-work times, you can be found at
ELECRAY7K, where you can read about me being silently horrified by the things I tweeted 8 years ago because of time hop. And you can see all the rugs that I want to buy right now. And I'm going to be setting up a webpage where you can go on there and buy me the rug of your choice, and I will put it in my home.
What a great opportunity. I would like to plug this podcast. As usual, I beg of you to rate and subscribe on iTunes if you're feeling verbose and friendly, which I know that a lot of you are out there. Please also write a review. It would be really great to get that counter up from 0 to 1. I'm looking forward to it.
I will do that. I will do that as soon as I get off. Can I plug some stuff that's not active, though?
Oh, sure.
That? Yeah, I'm going to plug my friend Susanna Polo's podcast, Cutscene from Polygon. Real good, real interesting stuff. They were talking about the Dark Tower the other week, and I thought about you, Kathy.
Nice. I love the Dark Tower.
Yeah, you should listen to this. It's pretty good. I'm going to plug. I haven't seen that, which does not need a plug from us. Probably
sister show to this show.
Yeah, sisters and sisters. I'm gonna plug Brian Weekly because I still think there's some good shit back there. So, and it's more or less sort of kind of not really done. Maybe someday. So go back.
It's done. It just is not up.
I really walked into that one. But yeah, go back and listen. Go back and listen to me and Kathy talking about vape.
Yeah, I will endorse that. And in addition, you can follow me on Twitter at MySocks. And
that's with an I,
M-I-S-O-K-S, not with the Y that you might expect.
It's like Michigan socks.
Michigan socks is actually a complex reference that nobody knows. It was great having you on today,
Always
Max.
Always a pleasure.
And I will see all you listeners next week.
Good night, everybody.